Welcome to Gruesome, your horrific true crime podcast. I am Meg, and old Constantinople Connie is going to tell us about Wesley Shermantine and Lauren Herzog.
You know, I was thinking, Meg and I were talking before we started recording, my HVAC is out, so like I'm waiting to get a replacement. And I was thinking, like, I am the embodiment right now of just like an extremely obese, sweaty guy sitting like on his couch watching TV, just like dripping in sweat. That's how I feel recording this episode. I'm so freaking hot.
You have like, do you have like a fan? You could.
Well, I do, but not when I'm recording because we'll, you know, it'll be
the noise. Yeah.
The noise. So I just want to let you guys all know that I am sweating my balls off for you. Love you all, big and small.
Love you all, big and small, even when I sweat my balls.
Yes, that's if you guys want that as a sticker, let me know.
All right, okay. Tell me about these nerds.
We have covered hundreds of murderers here on Gruesome of all different types. And the thrill killer is one that I cannot wrap my head around, because they are just motivated by the feeling of excitement that they get during their murders.
Is it the excitement of getting caught? Is it just the excitement of the act?
I think it varies based on, like, it varies from murderer to murderer in that situation.
Okay, gotcha.
But tonight we are going to talk about Lauren Herzog and Wesley Shermantine. And this disgusting duo would earn the name the Speed Freak Killers, which, again, stop giving them cool names.
Speed Freak?
Yeah, the Speed Freak Killers.
I'm trying to decide if it's like drug speed or like car speed.
Not drugs.
Okay,
speed.
Perfect.
These guys are not messing around. Lauren Joseph Herzog was born on December 8, 1965. He grew up in the small town of Linden, California, across the street from Wesley Howard Shermantine Jr., who was born on February 24, 1966. The idea of best friends living a street away from each other and only being a couple months apart has like all the makings of a 90s sitcom that can turn out to be very wholesome, but since we're covering them on the podcast, that is not the case. The boys grew up exploring San Joaquin County. And San Joaquin County, if you're not familiar with it, it houses cities such as Stockton, Tracy. Yeah, just bigger. Like, Stockton's pretty large. It has like 300,000 people who live there. But Linden barely has 2,000 residents. Shermantine's dad was a successful contractor in the area, and he often would take the boys on hunting and fishing trips until the boys were old enough to start to venture out on their own. Shermantine, by all accounts, was very spoiled. Between the trips he was given as a child and the gifts that his dad would shower him with, it left him with a sense of entitlement that he carried on well into adulthood. Shermantine and Herzog stayed friends almost by necessity because they were not very well liked. Even after high school and post-high school life, they stayed close. They lived in an apartment in the nearby town of Stockton where they partied, drank, and got really into drugs, specifically methamphetamine. Meth, if you're not familiar with this, and I have a question for all of our listeners who are outside of the United States, because I need to know if this is a United States, like, because I feel like every small town in the U.S. has problems with meth. And I just need to know if that's worldwide or if it's like United States specific.
I mean, I'm sure that there's a drug of choice for lots of small towns all over the world. Right?
Yeah, I'm
maybe,
just
maybe
to
it's
see.
Not meth, but I feel like
I know
it's
that
probably
like drugs,
something.
Yeah. I need to see the reach that meth has. But if you're not familiar with it, it is a very dangerous drug. And I could literally go on a soapbox rant for hours about it and how tough it is for an addict to quit. So if you are a recovering addict, I applaud you, because I've watched some of my favorite people battle that addiction and it is very rough. But one of the behavioral changes that come with methamphetamine use is increased hyperactivity, anxiety, mood swings, or even worse, violent behavior. Depending on the severity of their addiction, their behavior could threaten the safety of others around them. And it's not uncommon for people with a meth addiction to exhibit severe mood swings. So I actually, one of my favorite people, my cousin, is a recovering addict right now. And she is, I reached out to her and I was like, hey, not trying to be that person, but if you could be my subject matter expert on this for a little bit, how violent do you get when you're like actively using meth? And she said that one time she got tased several times and she just pulled them out of her. So,
oh my God.
It's pretty intense.
She's just, I can't imagine. The idea of getting tased one time makes me nervous.
Yeah, she was just, said she just like was the Incredible Hulk with it. But she's a rock star now. She is living her sober life and has her shit together, and we love to see it. The dynamic was one that we see a lot in duo killers, where one is the dominant and one is more submissive. Shermantine was the dominant personality. He was the more aggressive one of the two. He learned pretty early on in their friendship that he could get Herzog to do anything that he wanted. He was able to easily manipulate him. Whenever Shermantine started a brawl, Herzog was right there with him, following him blindly into whatever situation that Shermantine saw fit at the time. The two kept girls around them with the promise of drugs, but unfortunately for the girls, the meth-fueled nights often ended in violence, or worse, even rape. The men graduated from high school in 1984, and shortly after began Herzog and Shermantine's 15-year crime and murder spree. And when I post pictures of these two, you're going to be like, they look like the Sticky Bandits from Home Alone.
Mm-hmm.
Because they do.
I'm so excited to see that.
One of the earliest disappearances that is associated with Shermantine and Herzog is the disappearance of 16-year-old Ruth Ann Lehman. She disappeared in 1982, so the boys would have been about 16, 17 at the time. And she had spent a lot of time with Herzog before her disappearance, and the two are still considered suspects. Her body has never been located. Right after graduation in 1984, the pair were driving around in a truck along Highway 88 in the Hope Valley, California area near Lake Tahoe, when they passed a car that was pulled over on the side of the road. The story is that Shermantine got out of the truck and walked over to the car with his shotgun pulled and asked him, "Are you okay, buddy?" And the driver, 41-year-old Henry Howell, had pulled over because he was intoxicated. With little warning, Shermantine shot Henry Howell point blank with his shotgun after beating him with the barrel of the, or like the butt of the gun, and then he stole what little money he had. And then they just left his body there to be found and just rolled out.
Oh, not okay.
Yeah, just like a very like, oh, this is what we're doing. Not even 2 months later, in August of 1984, the duo was out cruising around again on Roberts Island when they passed another parked car, this time a 1982 Pontiac. They circled around and pulled up behind the car, and they both got out with their shotguns this time. 35-year-old Howard Michael King III was sitting behind the wheel of the car when he was ambushed by Shermantine and shot. The passenger, Paul Raymond Cavanaugh, who was 31, was dragged out of the passenger side and hit several times with the stock of the rifle before being shot point blank in the head and left for dead on the side of the road. Witnesses would place a red truck similar to what Shermantine drove near the scene, and tire tracks that matched his were also found there. The two not being caught or questioned in relation to the three murders just further fueled their God complex that they were above it all, that there was nothing that they couldn't get away with, and that they were invincible. A year later, in September of 1985, the pair met Robin Armtrout at a park in Stockton. They asked her if she wanted to go out drinking with them, and she agreed. She was just 24 years old when her paths crossed these two monsters. Shermantine drove her out into the middle of nowhere, and Herzog would later say that she knew something was wrong as soon as she realized that they were like away from everything and in the middle of nowhere. He pulled into a pasture not far from where the two lived, and Shermantine began beating and raping Robin. She was screaming out, but Herzog just stood by idly, allegedly, this is what he says, as Shermantine pulled out a 4-inch hunting knife and began stabbing her more than a dozen times before discarding her nude body on the bank of Potter Creek, where it was later discovered by a dove hunter. The medical examiner would note that her stab wounds were mostly on her back and her chest. A month later, on Wednesday, October 16th, 1985, Chevelle Wheeler, who went by Chevy, skipped school to go hang out with a friend in a red pickup. She told her friends that she was going with this friend to Valley Springs, but told her friend to tell her dad if she did not return. She felt apprehension about going on the trip in the first place. When her parents reported her missing to the police, they told her that Shermantine had called her house that morning. So, of course, when questioned by detectives, he denied any involvement. Police knew that she had been seen getting into this red pickup truck, and as we know, that's what he drove. They learned that his family owned a cabin in San Andreas, California, and when they searched it, they found blood and hair evidence. Although the blood samples matched Chevy's blood type, it was not enough immediately to bring charges against Shermantine because DNA testing in 1985 could not analyze with the precision that we have today. So it was able to say this is her blood type, but it couldn't specifically DNA match her. They could only tell that it matched her blood type, which also matched thousands of other people's blood type. Without Chevy's body and no way to completely link the DNA found at the crime, without Chevy's body and no way to completely link the DNA found at the crime scene to Chevy's, the pair walked free again. But do not fret, because I am telling you, I didn't want to leave you guys hanging. Justice would be served for Chevy Wheeler. But for more than 10 years, her case would remain open and cold, despite that the family and the investigators knowing Shermantine had something to do with it, which I feel like would be the most frustrating. Now, this is a part that I don't really buy, and neither do many of the investigators who worked these murders, because the murders that they were tied to, because the way the records would have it is that these brutal murders were committed and then the two of them just stayed on the straight and narrow for 10 years. I don't believe that. I don't see there's any.
They just murdered two people together and then they're just like, you know what? Let's just chill out for about 10 years.
Well, at this point, it would be 3, 4, 5 people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, 5 people. Sheesh. And then just be like, we're done. I don't think you don't have that type of violent behavior. And then just be like,
I feel like maybe they went separate ways, but I don't think
exactly
nothing was going on during that time.
I agree. So fast forward in February of 1998, in the midst of Shermantine being in a custody battle with his soon to be ex-wife, he was arrested on kidnap and rape charges.
Yikes.
According to his victim, he called the woman at about 2 a.m. on February 14th saying that he was drunk and was asking for a ride to his father's house. So the two met at Silver Rapids and Highway 26. Shermantine drove to his father's house with the woman following behind him in her car. And then the story is that Shermantine got out of his car at a stoplight and tried to force the woman out of her own car. And then when she refused to get out, he's like, I'm going to take your car to a chop shop. And she's like, okay, I'll just report my car as stolen. Like, duh.
Okay, do it then.
Do it. So he got back in his car and drove away. But he returned 20 minutes later and forced the woman into the passenger seat of her car. And when she resisted, he punched her in the face and then drove to the end of the road in the edge of San Joaquin County, where he then raped her. His lawyer argued the woman's credibility because he said that she waited 3 days to report the rape. And disgustingly that he used this as an excuse, that sometimes she was an occasional sex worker. So he's like, look, she waited 3 days. Like, how bad could it have been? It's disgusting. But what he didn't realize is how often Shermantine talked about how he put women in the ground, how it was nothing for him to make a woman disappear, how one time he stuck his boot on a woman's head with her ear to the ground as he said, "Do you hear all of the heartbeats I buried in there?"
Ugh.
So naturally, the woman would be freaking terrified of this man. And when all of his crimes were revealed, it was no wonder that the woman was hesitant about coming forward. But unfortunately, this woman's account wasn't enough. And on June 26, 1998, he was acquitted.
What? Mm-hmm. On the she waited 3 days thing?
Yeah, like on the rape charge. Yeah. And they don't have her name out there because she's still alive. So they were protecting her privacy. I found two articles where they had mentioned it, but I was like, no, let her move on from this. And obviously now he had been tried, acquitted. So now he really thought that he could do whatever the hell he wanted and that mm-hmm. he was just completely invincible. So back in the day when the two were younger, Herzog dated a girl named Kim Vanderheiden, and her dad owned a bar that the two hung out at a lot. So her family knew the reputation of Herzog and Schermantine. They knew that they were violent. They knew that they caused a lot of trouble, that they were accused of rape, that they were avid drug users. And
knew
again,
all about them.
Yes. And this is a small town, like 2,000 people. My town is small, and my kids only have like 100 kids in each grade, and we have like 6,000 people in town. So I can't even imagine only having like 2,000 people. So when Kim's sister, Cindy Vanderheiden, went missing, it didn't take long for the eyes to be pointed right back at Schermantine and Herzog. On the evening of November 13th, 1998, Cindy had gone to a karaoke bar in Linden, California with a friend. Later that evening, another friend drove her car to another bar in the town where Cindy lived with her parents. Once parked outside of the bar, she told her friend that she would drive herself back to her family's house, and which was only like a mile away. So a guy friend followed her home early that morning, and he told police, "I saw her park her car in her parents' driveway at like 2:30 in the morning." But he didn't wait to see if she went inside the house. He did what all of us would do, like, "All right, she's home." And her mom told investigators, like, "I heard Cindy arrive home, but she was never heard from again after that."
After that, she got dropped off at 2:30 in the morning. No one ever heard from her.
Okay. No. And her father found her Cavalier parked at Glenview Cemetery in Clements later that day. And so a search, like this is after the search had been initiated. The car was unlocked and her purse and cell phone were still inside. Police attempted to piece together what had happened, and it was theorized that she must have left her parents' home again shortly after pulling into the driveway to go to the cemetery. Police immediately questioned Schermantine and Cindy's disappearance, and deep down in their gut, they knew that he was involved, but they had no physical evidence to go on. But in January of 1999, so just two months later, local deputies got a call that Schermantine's car was about to be repossessed. And I guess that when a car gets repoed, the cops have to get a call to, like, heads up, we're taking this car back just in case someone reports it as stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So the cops were like, ding, 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 here's our chance. We finally can get a search warrant for this car, where they discovered remnants of blood. And they sent the blood for a DNA test. And because it's now 1999 and not 1985, they have the option to where they can do specific DNA testing now. With the blood being found in the car, they also now had a reason to recheck the hair blood that was found in the cabin from back in 1985. Because police believed back then that they knew that hair and blood belonged to Chevy Wheeler, but now they were finally able to prove it, and it came back a match. So armed with new evidence, and after linking the two suspected killers, Schermantine and Herzog were arrested on Thursday, March 18th, 1999, on suspicion of murder. Both men were later charged with the kidnapping and murder of Cindy Vanderheiden. Schermantine was also later charged with the murder of Chevy Wheeler. Police started their questioning with Herzog because they assumed that he was the weakest link. But they were worried because they knew that these two were thick-ass thieves. Like, they were each other's ride or die, and they were worried
they weren't going to rat on each other.
Yep, but they were so fucking wrong.
They never, like, they're, you can be best friends forever. Or you could be like, yeah, we've been business partners for 20 years. And the second they're like, well, either you can go to jail forever or they can go to jail forever. They're like, it was them. They definitely.
Yeah, they're like, well, one thing about me is I'm a snitch. And for 17 hours, 17 hours, that's exactly what Herzog did.
He snitched for 17 hours straight?
17 fucking hours, dude.
He was like, and you know what? That reminds me of another thing.
That's what he did.
He's like, oh, yeah, we cut that girl one time. But actually, there was another time. And you know what what happened after that? Then he called me up one night. There was already a dead girl there.
Yeah, that's pretty much what he did. Yeah, it's like pretty spot on. Like if you look up the 17-hour interrogation because you can watch it and then listen to what Meg just said, they're the same.
That was actually reenactment of the video.
He detailed the night that him and Shermantine met with Cindy Vanderheiden. He said that Shermantine had asked Cindy to meet with them at the cemetery near her home after she had left the bar. According to Herzog, the three of them met sometime after 2:30, and it was not clear exactly how they all three came to be like hanging out at the same place at the same time. But regardless, again, small town, hanging out at bars, it's what you do. After Vanderheiden met up with Herzog and Shermantine, she left her car at the cemetery, and then the trio went back to Linden, where Shermantine supposedly pulled a knife and ordered Cindy to perform oral sex on him. According to Herzog's statement, Shermantine then stopped the car, raped Sydney, and slashed her throat. He also detailed the night that Robin Armtrout was murdered. He said that Shermantine also bragged about doing the same thing to Chevy Wheeler, that he got her in the car and then killed her. He talked about the murdering of Howard King and Paul Kavanaugh that we talked about earlier. He randomly threw in that in 1994, they were in northern Utah and Shermantine shot a random hunter. And when police reached out to the local investigators, they were like, yeah, there is an unsolved murder here of a murderer or of a hunter. Shortly after Herzog and Shermantine's arrest, FBI agents raided Shermantine's parents' home in San Andreas and confiscated nearly $40,000 worth of guns, which were examined by evidence technicians attempting to link them to other unsolved crimes. Shermantine was told about Herzog's 17-hour-long blab fest. He goes, I cannot believe he would say that. Herzog and Herzog alone was to blame for Cindy Vanderheiden's death. He also said that he could provide information that he might know the location of where Vanderheiden's corpse and where other bodies could be. And you may be thinking, Connie, it seems like Herzog had nothing to do with this. Like the way he tells the story, he was always just this innocent bystander doof. And really, that's the story that he tried to spin. So when the 17-hour interrogation, because they were like, hey, you actually look, this is what he's been saying about you, bro, my boy. This is what he's been saying. This is 17
so
hours.
He's been saying, my boy.
Grab some popcorn and sit here for damn near a whole day. And Shermantine said, quote, the more I've heard about all the stuff I'm supposed to have done, the madder I get. I'm tired of being used and manipulated by Lauren. If Lauren can give details about all these murders, it must mean that he's the one that did them. I'm innocent. I've done nothing wrong to any of these people. With everything Lauren told the detectives, I'd bet my life there were other bodies out there. And I was like, you both are shitty people. You both are monsters.
Absolutely.
This was a duo. Like, this was not just one innocent guy. In 1990-
also, I feel like when it's a duo, they're more likely to just, like, keep trying. Like, they're never going to take full responsibility. Like, no one's going to be like, you's right, it was all me.
You like, have a patsy right there. You have, like, yes. A patsy. In 1999, shortly after the duo's arrest, Shermantine hinted that at least one body, possibly others, may have been hidden in an abandoned mine shaft in eastern San Joaquin County. Investigators learned that the two, while growing up, had sometimes explored mine shafts in the area, And Herzog had once remarked in a drunken stupor that mine shafts would be a great place to hide a body. And Schermantine did an interview with a magazine and was like, he'd get to drinking and crying and telling me about all the wrong things he'd done in his life. Then he'd start telling me about all the places he'd put people. So again, more of the just going back and forth and blaming each other.
And threatening, or it sounds like what he did a lot was just like, intimidate other people with all the things that he had done so that they wouldn't ever retaliate.
Exactly. During Schermantine's trial, which began on November 22nd, 2000, it had to be moved to Santa Clara because of the extensive publicity about the case through San Joaquin Valley. Prosecutors painted a picture of this cold-blooded predator who had been on a rampage for 15 years, to which I agree. On trial for the murder of Chevy Wheeler in 1985, Cindy Vander Heidens in 1998, and Paul Cavanaugh and Howard King in 1984, the trial began against the wishes of Schermantine's lawyers. The lawyers had argued that the case involving male victims should be tried separately from the case involving the female victims because the charges against Schermantine and the deaths of King and Cavanaugh arose largely just from the statements of Herzog. So they were like, they should, pretty much what they were saying is like, look, we know you have evidence to convict him with the murder of these girls, but the only evidence you have against him in the murder of these men are what Herzog said. But the prosecutors were like, nah, we're going to proceed on. During the course of the trial, five women testified that Schermantine had sexually assaulted them, including a babysitter whom he attacked when she attempted to collect the money that he owed her. A woman testified that her car had once been rear-ended by Schermantine, and then he proceeded to kidnap her at knife point when she got out to exchange insurance information.
Oh, my God.
And then his ex-wife recounted that she had been beaten by him several times over the years and that he had even beaten her while she was pregnant. Schermantine was convicted of the four murders and in May of 2001 was sentenced to death by San Joaquin County Judge Michael Garrigan. Schermantine angrily protested that he was innocent and he never killed no one. He even cried at one point saying that Chevy Wheeler had been his friend. But then he proceeded to tell her parents that they would never find their daughter's body. He had offered the authorities, he told them that if they gave him $20,000 that he could give to his kids, that he would provide them with the location of two bodies. And they were like, no, we're not going to do that. Herzog went to trial in August of 2001 for the murders of Cindy Vander Heidens, Howard King, Paul Cavanaugh, Robin Armtrout, and Henry Howell. Like Schermantine, Herzog had been granted a change of venue to Santa Clara because of the pre-trial publicity. It took until nearly mid-October 2001 for his trial to be finished, and then another 2 weeks for the jury to deliberate. When the jury came back on Monday, October 22nd, 2001, it found Herzog not guilty of the murders of Robin Armtrout and Henry Howell. The jury did convict him, however, of first-degree murders on Cindy Vander Heidens, Howard King III, and Paul Cavanaugh. The verdict did not call for special circumstances, though, which meant that he would not face the death penalty. On Monday, December 10, 2001, he was sentenced to 78 years in prison by Judge Michael Garrigan, making him eligible for parole at some point. But in August of 2004, an appeals court overturned all of Herzog's convictions, ruling that three of Herzog's four confessions were coerced. And in the case of the fourth, so in the case of like Cindy Vander Heidens, a retrial was ordered, but the retrial never took place. Rather, a plea bargain was reached and he pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter and furnishing amphetamine in the Vander Heidens case and to being an accessory to murder in the Cavanaugh, King, and Howard cases. His sentence was reduced to 14 years with credit for 6 years served. With the credit off his sentence for good behavior, Herzog served 11 years in prison and was paroled on September 18th, 2010. And then this caused like a huge ruckus because he didn't have anywhere to go. And the city was like, we don't want you living here. So he ended up living in this trailer outside of the High Desert State Prison.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like 200 miles away from like all of his family, away from Stockton.
Good.
Yeah. Like kind of just isolated. And the citizens of Lassen County, where he lived, they protested because they were like, why the fuck is he here? And then so they had to like have like additional safety measures and everything. But the conditions of his parole were that he was required to wear a GPS bracelet, and it went off if he was more than 150 feet from his trailer. He and all visitors had to check in and out with the gatehouse operator. He could not leave his trailer between the hours of 8:30 p.m. and 5:30 a.m. and from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. Because of his tight restrictions, he was not required to work. So he was out of prison, isolated and alone, and still under the watchful eye of all of the authorities. However, again, 2 years after his release, a bounty hunter informed Herzog that Schermantine intended to tell police about a well and two other locations of victims. That same bounty hunter, Leonard Padilla, promised Schermantine $30,000 for information, and Schermantine drew a map to a well site in Linden. Padilla reached out to Herzog and told him that Schermantine was going to be cooperating with him. And hours later, on January 16th, 2012, Herzog's GPS ankle monitor died, prompting parole officers to go to his trailer, where they found him inside, having died by suicide. He left a note that said, "Tell my family I love them," before he hanged himself. Investigators...
No.
Yeah. Investigators followed the map that Schermantine drew and dug through the site, which the two called their boneyard, finding over 1,000 human remains, including a rotted fetus.
What? In the well?
Mm-hmm. So like 1,000 different bone pieces.
What?
The FBI.
How many bodies is that?
Oh, we're going to talk about that in just a second.
Okay. Thank you.
The FBI took over the case after local authorities' poor handling of the dig and sent the remains for DNA testing. On March 30th, 2012, they announced the identities of two people found in a well, Kimberly Ann Billy and Joanne Hobson, who both disappeared in 1984 and 1985, respectively. Schermantine identified two other burial sites on property once owned by his family where the bodies of Chevelle Wheeler and Cindy Vanderheiden were found. In 2018, the investigation of the dubbed Speed Freak Killers cases were reopened. Since then, over 1,000 human remains have been found, and the mishandling of the case has gone to federal courts. Investigators continue to work to identify the remains and bring some sense of peace to the families who have waited at this point like decades for answers. It is believed that the two could be responsible for up to 72 murders. In March of 2023, as we all know, California Governor Gavin Newsom announced that the state's infamous death row would be closed, transforming San Quentin State Prison into a restorative justice facility. As part of the shift, the people, or the inmates that were on death row, were going to be placed in different prisons. And mm-hmm. Schermantine was on death row with Carrie Stainer, a case that we covered previously.
Yeah, we did do that one. It was like, that was in California too, right? Duh, yeah. Obviously it was.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. Wow. And I believe when they found the remains of Chevy and Cindy, it was like fragmented.
Just parts of them.
Yeah, because Cindy's parents were, that's part of the reason, like with the mishandling, because of the way her skull was returned or something like that.
Sheesh. But yeah,
I fully believe what happened with Herzog is he was an active participant in all of this. And he, as soon as he realized that they were going to find, he was going to give them a map, because like he drew out like a full map that mm-hmm. he knew that his days in parole were going to be over.
Yeah, no joke.
And it's like, you can't maintain that you're not guilty when now you have all of these bodies that can be tied to you.
And so he was just like, yeah, I mean, he wouldn't. Gross. Did you say how many? Like
up to 72 murders.
That's crazy.
And Shermantine, there are times when he admits to all of them. There are times when he says he goes back and he didn't do anything. He's been very vocal with like writing to newspapers and magazines and just being a big dipshit.
Yeah, that the bone fat fragment thing reminds me of the Herb Baumeister case. How like they found all the pieces all over his yard, and it was.
I thought about that too.
There are so many that you can't like. You don't know how many there are, and you'll never be able to really know or who they were, and that's horribly sad.
Well, especially when they're so familiar with the landscape that they know all these mine shafts, they know these wells, they know places where they can hide people. But yeah, that Padilla, the bounty hunter, was like, he's about to tell on you. Just a heads up. Anything you want to say? And then he was like, nah, I'm just going to like.
No, could die. You leave so that I can make it happen myself? Ugh, what a creep.
Yeah, they're both.
What creeps?
They're both. Ugh. But yeah, that was the case.
Well, that's a bummer.
Mm-hmm. And it makes me also. Never really want to experiment with meth.
Look, I feel like I don't think it was just the meth.
I don't think so either. No, I think there's a lot of really nice people who are addicted to meth who are not killing 72.
Yeah, there's tons of people who do meth that are not murderers.
Like, oh, for sure.
It's just like there are lots of people who are abused who are not murderers. It's, ugh.
Yep.
Well, that was certainly gruesome, Connie.
I haven't covered serial killers in a while. I was hung up on kids that killed their parents, and I was like, I got to get out of this.
I gotta get out of this. And you know what's funny is my next one is, well, you know, it's kind of a serial killer. But... we just get on the same wavelength.
Yeah, our brains are kindred.
Kindred spirits.
How is the everyone's dying to know how the chouse is going?
The church house. It's awesome. We love it. I don't like sitting in boxes, so it's pretty much all unpacked and put together for now. It's just like it feels like home a lot already, and it's, I have so much house that I don't really know what to do with a lot of it. The basement is empty, and I was just like, we have so much storage. This basement is massive, and we have put nothing in it because we have room for everything upstairs. Mm-hmm. So there's just...
is that where you're going to put the gym?
The gym is, so our house is weird. If you don't know, bought a house, it's a church. The front half of the house has been flipped from a church into like a home, like a 4-bedroom home. And then there is an apartment on the back half of the church that is separate. It's like a 2-3-bedroom apartment, like a 2-bedroom apartment in the back. And there is a basement that connects both the apartment and the house. Okay. So the basement expands both areas. And in the apartment half of the basement, we have the gym.
Okay. That's where eventually your office will be?
Well, my office is in the apartment.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think what's most impressive is that you don't have any boxes.
Yeah, no, I can't live that way. It drives me crazy. Like, I need to feel like home. And I said, like, once I'm here and I feel like everything's in its place, I will focus on getting like my office actually set up. And like, remember, was it last year when like you totally redid your office and made it?
Yeah,
really cool?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll probably do that in the next couple of months over in the apartment side. Just get it to where like I like to go over there and I want to go over there. But right now, like my bedroom feels more like home. So it's easier to
yeah,
in there.
Yeah.
It's just more comfortable for me.
Dude, I can't wait to come see it.
Yeah.
I'm almost done with our busy part of life. May is like shit for both of us.
June. It's not shit. It's great. It's awesome.
It's great. It's your all awesome things. It's happening. All awesome things.
I like everything that's happening in May. It's my birthday month.
Yes, it's officially Meg's birthday month.
Woo woo. I'm going to be 35. Here we go. I'm excited though. I've been telling people I was turning 35 for like the last 4 months. Pretty much as soon as 2024 hit, I'm just like, yeah, I'm 35.
I'm like, I'm 30. I'm a baby. I'm a little baby. All right, guys.
Have you ever seen Three Amigos?
No. Wait, the cartoon?
No, that's Three Caballeros. I knew you were thinking of along the same lines. It's the one with Steve Martin and Chevy Chase and
I've seen parts, yeah.
Well, there's a part where he's like, they're celebrating his 40th birthday, and he's like, we're going to celebrate his, and he looks at him, and he goes, 33rd birthday, and everybody cheers. It's funny. Makes me laugh.
That's me. That's how I
I was going to say, it reminded me of you. I was like, that's what Connie would want.
Yeah, that's definitely.
Her 33rd birthday.
Like, when I turn 40, I'm just doing, like, a 21st birthday again.
You just restart?
Yeah.
My mom said she was 21 for years and years and years. Like, every birthday was her 21st birthday. I was like, Mom, I don't think you can get away with 21 after 60. Like, you can't.
Your mom can.
It doesn't work like that anymore.
If anyone's getting away with it, it's your mom.
Don't hype her up like that. We won't know what to do with her if she has that kind of, she has 21-year-old energy no one would be able to handle.
She'll be unstoppable. The best part is we know she's not going to hear this because neither one of our parents listened to this.
At dinner the other night, my boyfriend asked, he's like, so who listens to your podcast that's like in your family? And I was like, no one. No one listens. That's why I can just talk shit about them all day, every day.
Yeah.
Fuck you guys. Why don't you support me the way I would support you?
We just turn it into our own therapy session.
Yeah, and then the end of every episode is us crying about how our moms don't love us. Like, they love us. They just have different priorities in life.
It's St. Karen's birthday too. Her birthday's Monday.
Happy birthday, Karen.
She is also turning 35. No, I'm just kidding.
She would be furious if she heard you say that.
I think she's 32. 32? No, yeah. 32, I think. Maybe 31.
We were messaging on Instagram the other day discussing our love of naturescape playgrounds. Because I went to this new playground. It was so cool. It had a splash pad, but then it had like a giant man-made creek attached to the splash pad that you could also like creek stomp in. And I was like, this is awesome.
I need to bring homegirl up there.
Yeah, for sure. Bring her and we'll go have splash pad day with the little kids. That'll be fun. I too will be in the splash pad.
Dude, same. Same. I fucking love a splash pad. Whoever came up with the idea of a splash pad, kudos to you, because it is my favorite place to take my kids.
I'll swim in anything. Well, splash pads for your kids, yeah, because you're like, there's no fear of drowning there. I'm not saying that that's never happened, but what I am saying is, like, I feel more comfortable, like, scrolling on my phone or reading my book when my kids are playing at a splash pad than I do if they're, like, in a pool.
Sometimes I'm just like, man, you're going to have some gnarly diarrhea after all of this water that you've drank, but whatever.
You've been drinking everyone's recycled pee water. I don't know if that's how splash pads work. Probably not.
That's how I'm assuming it works.
It's like, have you ever Googled how water on cruise ships work?
Nope. Not even going to do it.
Yeah, I would recommend not doing it then. But if you ever want to see something, you should Google that. Give it a goog.
We've had like such a, it's like Mercury was definitely in retrograde because it's just like everything that was happening bad to us, like my specific household. And I mean that like my household, no one else in the world was having any problems at the same time, just me in the entire world. Cause it's,
it was just Connie versus the world.
And We had the issue with our HVAC. Well, then I told my husband all winter, hey, can you make sure the golf cart batteries are still trucking because it's winter time? And he's like, they're fine, Connie. They're fine. Well, they weren't fine. And I had just bought them. And we finally got like a different charger to like really juice them up.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw the glimmer of hope in his eyes because I just kept looking at him. If I have to buy different batteries again this year after, because they're like a, I think we spent like $1,200 or $1,300 on these.
On golf cart batteries?
Yeah, because there's like six of them in a golf cart.
Jeez, I didn't know that.
And I just looked at him when they stayed, like two of them stayed charged after he like used this new charger. I looked at him. I was like, you are so lucky, sir. He's like, I know. I know. He's like, I've been, and he just texted me. He's like, man, I'm so fucking relieved about those batteries that you're not going to kill me. And I'm like, I wasn't going to kill you. I was just going to be super bummed, man. I already have to pay a bajillion dollars for an HVAC. I'm going to start a GoFundMe just for my.
For your HVAC?
Yeah. GoFundMe for life.
For Connie's sweaty balls. Sweaty balls.
Hey, but my new medicine, shout out to Vraylar, because it is fucking kicking. It is kicking the door down with this anxiety, man.
What is it called?
Vraylar.
I'm Googling it.
It's an antipsychotic, but it's really doing its thing.
Just curious.
Just curious. It's what they call a designer drug, because I'm a fancy bitch.
That doesn't make you fancy. That just means...
mental health is expensive. Yeah. I sent Meg a picture of it because there's not a generic. And the retail price is like $1,700 a month. And I was like, yeah. Thank God for insurance, man.
Yeah, I don't... Actually, we can kind of talk about that because I don't have insurance. That's the cool thing about working in the dental field is that most of us don't have a health insurance.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, you think because it's medical, you would get it. And you usually get dental. Like, usually if you work in an office.
Hold on okay. Real quick. Hey, boys, I'm recording. Can you be quiet? Okay.
Okay. If you work at a dental office, you usually get dental. Like, they'll do your dental stuff for, like, really cheap or free. And then you just have to pay lab fees if you need anything, like a crown made or something. But you don't get health insurance. And I was buying... birth control, and I went to the place, and I used to have a different insurance, but I don't have any anymore. And I was trying to, I went to go pick mine up, and they were like, hey, we can't sell this to you. And I was like, well, I don't have insurance. I'm just paying cash. And they were like, yeah, well, this provider that sent it in, they aren't qualified with the insurance that used to be on your account. So now, even if we paid cash, if like they audited us, we would get in trouble for it. And like, I know pharmacy techs have a hard job. I'm not trying to make their lives harder. I was just like, oh, okay. And I was like, I'll go call them and talk to them. So then I had to call a bunch of people. It's like kind of a nightmare for something that I should just be able to pick up at like.
Yeah, you should just be able to go buy it.
Be able to buy it over the counter. Yes.
Yeah.
I was annoyed about it.
So what did they do? Did they just have to prescribe something else?
I called and I got something else, but I'm seeing if the same thing is going to happen with that. Because I've gotten a different kind before and there were no issues, but this kind didn't. So I sent another one in. I had another one sent in, and I just got a text last night that said that they were placing an order and working on it. So who knows?
Dude.
Who knows? It's just slowly but surely I'll find out.
Yeah, 9 months. No, I'm just kidding.
Dude, but that's, I was thinking about that. Like, people who need it and like don't have quick access to it, and how in the end, like, it ends up being a baby that's way more expensive than what they wanted. I just,
that's wild. I agree, man. It's bullshit.
It's bullshit.
Well, I think that's a good place to end it.
On our fury against birth control.
Fury. All right, guys. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Gruesome, Horrific, True Crime.
We love you, beautiful strangers. And if you love us too, here are some ways that you can support Gruesome. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or a 5-star rating on Spotify. This helps other true crime connoisseurs find us. Follow us at Gruesome Podcasts on Instagram or TikTok and talk to us on our posts.
Join the Patreon. Sign up to join our True Crime Sticker of the Month Club and gain access to bonus episodes and exclusive Patreon perks. Or if a one-time donation is more your thing, we have a Venmo at Gruesome Podcast and a PayPal via our email, gruesomepodcast@gmail.com.
Speaking of which, we love hearing from you. It seriously makes our whole life. So send us your questions, comments, suggestions, or just ask our opinion on whether that person you met on Tinder is a serial killer or not.
Tune in next week, and don't forget, lock your windows, lock your doors, and on Wednesdays,
we're gruesome.
Bye.
Bye.